Welcome to Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson. It's a city known for the automobile industry and the soul pop legacy of Motown Records. But Detroit is also a great jazz capital. In the next hour, I'll talk with Mark Stryker, author of the book Jazz from Detroit.
You cannot tell the history of jazz in America without also telling the history of jazz from Detroit.
And we'll hear some of the artists that emerged from the mid-20th century jazz scene in that city, such as Barry Harris, Thad Jones, Donald Byrd, Milt Jackson, Gerald Wilson, and Curtis Fuller. It's Made in Detroit, Jazz from the Motor City, Part 1, coming up on this edition of Nightlights. Thank you. Detroit trumpeter Donald Byrd and his composition Devil Whip, with Byrd joined there by fellow Detroiter Pepper Adams on baritone saxophone, Charlie Rouse on tenor saxophone, Walter Davis Jr. on piano, Sam Jones on bass, and Art Taylor on drums. That track originally appeared on Byrd's 1959 Blue Note album, Byrd in Hand. The roll call of notable jazz musicians who've come from Detroit, Michigan, could fill up a fair amount of this Nightlights program if I were to read the nearly 200 names listed in an appendix to Mark Stryker's book Jazz from Detroit. The brothers Thad, Hank, and Elvin Jones, pianist Barry Harris, guitarist Kenny Burrell, trumpeter Donald Byrd, trombonist Curtis Fuller, bandleader Gerald Wilson, and vibraphonist Milt Jackson are just a few of the players who could comprise a jazz supergroup drawn from Detroit. They emerged from a rich musical mid-20th century environment described by Stryker in his book. Music of all kinds was omnipresent in black communities in Detroit, in schools, bars, barbershops, dance halls, living rooms, backyards, basements, and community centers. Gospel, hymns, blues, jazz, classical, and early R&B were all part of the mix. Jazz seeped out of clubs, under doors, and through windows, coating the streets and black neighborhoods in a thick haze of blues and swing. How did this explosion of talent come about? Mark Stryker.
We have this very complex marriage of social, economic, and political and educational conditions that arise in the middle of the 20th century that lead to this explosion. The Great Migration brings hundreds of thousands of African Americans north during the first half of the 20th century. A lot of folks come to Detroit drawn by the auto industry, which is creating some of the best paying jobs for blacks in America. So Detroit is really on the leading edge of creating a black middle and working class. So you have a thriving entertainment industry that arises in a city like that, where you have a lot of African Americans, everybody's working, you got money, and so this network of nightlife, clubs, bars, restaurants emerges. At the same time, in Detroit, you have some of the best music education in the public schools in the country. The schools are integrated in Detroit, and kids really learn how to play their instruments formally very well in the European tradition. And so you have that going on. Then you have really important mentors in the community, people like, in the 1950s, in particular, Barry Harris, the great pianist, who is quite literally teaching people in his home. And his students include people like Paul Chambers and Doug Watkins and Donald Byrd and Curtis Fuller and Yusef Lateef, even though Yusef is older, studies with Barry. And then Barry's next class, you know, includes Joe Henderson and Charles McPherson. And so essentially what you have in Detroit then is this marriage of formal education in the schools combined with this informal mentorship that they're getting in the community from Barry and others. And all of that's happening within an economically vibrant community where these musicians have a chance to play nightly at an extremely high level. And you put all those things together, you get this profound explosion at mid-century.
Those foundations helped Detroit jump out ahead when bebop revolutionized the jazz world of the 1940s.
Because Detroit musicians were so well trained, that's a major reason, I believe, why bebop is adopted so quickly in Detroit. Because when bebop happens in the early 40s, the music and mid-40s, the music requires a certain level of virtuosity and a certain knowledge of harmony and a kind of facility that was kind of optional for older players. Some players had that, but others did not. But bebop really demands a kind of virtuosity on their instrument. And because the Detroit musicians were so well trained in school, they had all of that at their fingers, and they immediately, instinctually, like, recognized how Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie's music was sort of working on a harmonic level. And they got it. And they could apply those lessons right away because they had the chops to do it. So there's a kind of ripple effect about the impact of education that we might not think of right away. But when you ask the question, well, why did Detroit become such a center for bebop? Right away, in sort of real time, that educational foundation becomes really important.
Then there was pianist Barry Harris, a one-man educational system of his own.
Jazz is an oral tradition. It's taught, it's learned on the bandstand, and the information is passed down from musician to musician. But you still need fundamental skills of playing your instrument. And, you know, in Detroit, you had both. You had that formal training, and then you had Barry Harris, who is the epitome of the oral tradition, teaching this music in his home. And one of the things that's so fascinating about Barry is that the concepts that Barry is sort of figuring out for himself in the early 50s by listening to Charlie Parker and Bud Powell and Dizzy Gillespie, and in his own mind creating a kind of codification, but in a very non-academic way, and learning how to transmit that, those ideas become foundational for what's taught in every jazz program across the country.
Detroit pianist Barry Harris and Stay Right With It with Bob Cranshaw on bass and Clifford Jarvis on drums from Harris's 1962 album Chasing the Bird. A thriving club scene and supportive audiences also helped fuel the surge of jazz talent in Detroit.
It's important to remember that jazz is social music. It grew out of the African American community. It is embedded deeply within African American culture. And in Detroit, that was incredibly strong at the middle of the 20th century. And there was a feeling among the African American community that this is our life, this is our music, these are our musicians. And that connection that people felt, the musicians felt, is really important. And Elvin Jones talks about this. He was reflecting on the audiences at the World Stage, which is an important venue in Detroit, where they had jam sessions and concerts, and the New Music Society, which was an organization actually that Kenny Burrell was the president of in the early 50s, sponsored these sessions and performances, and young musicians could mix it up with older established musicians at these sessions. And Elvin talks about the fact that he felt like the entire audience was in on the creation of this art form. He said, you know, he'd never experienced anything like that, like a whole community invested in sustaining and holding up this art form.
Thank you.
Saxophonist Yusuf Lateef, pianist Barry Harris, trumpeter Donald Byrd, bassist Alvin Jackson, drummer Frank Gant, and Bernard McKinney on euphonium performing Shaw Nuff at Detroit's New World Stage in 1955. Though Detroit audiences were supportive, they and the musicians themselves demanded a high level of playing, one which served those musicians well when they ventured into jazz scenes elsewhere.
Pepper Adams talks about the fact that he didn't understand how high the standards were in Detroit until he left Detroit. And then he began to understand that, say, well, not everybody played with good time. Everybody in Detroit played with good time. So Pepper assumed that everybody played with good time. It wasn't until he got out in the rest of the world that he realized that the standards were not as high. So you had to be at a very high level to compete. And so that edge was important.
One Detroit musician who set his own high standards outside of Detroit was trumpeter and bandleader Gerald Wilson, whose mid-1940s orchestra was one of the most progressive and exciting ensembles of the era.
What's so fascinating about the band in the 1940s is that you can hear Gerald's swing-era roots, his roots in Ellington and in Lunsford, with whom he played, but you can hear it morphing into bebop just within the course of a single arrangement or a single phrase. So if you think about the Dissonance in Blues, which opens in a slow tempo, kind of a walking blues tempo, and there's a mysterioso kind of beginning, and there's a bass solo, and it's very Ellington-ish at that point. I mean, first of all, there were who in that era wrote bass features. Ellington is basically the only one at the big band level. And so you've got Gerald doing that. And then the chart kind of, as it develops, it sort of wakes up and the saxophones come in and the line they play really begins to move forward into bebop. And you can kind of feel this march into the future. And then there are brass interjections that begin to have a kind of double time to it that again sounds and feels like bebop.
Detroit bandleader Gerald Wilson and his composition Dissonance and Blues, recorded in 1947. Vibraphonist Milt Jackson was yet another Detroit jazz musician who made an impact in the wider world of jazz.
Milt essentially, you know, translated Charlie Parker's language to the vibes and is really is the vibraphone player that basically made that instrument a truly expressive instrument by making it a vocal kind of expression. You know, Milt was a sound innovator. He took the vibes, which had previously been played in kind of a nervous, twitchy kind of sound with a very fast vibrato, tremolo. You know, there's it's an electronic mechanism that whirls a little disc within the pipes that makes the sound of the vibes, gives an impression of vibrato. And what Milt did was he turned down the speed of the tremolo so that disc was only revolving about 3.5 times in a second rather than a much faster rate previous to him. And that created a kind of vocal-like expression analogous to a vibrato that a singer or an instrumentalist would play with. So that's why Milt's music sounds so human, because he's really singing on the instrument. So you combine that kind of expression with his blues roots, and it's very powerful. I sing a lot of couple of tracks in the book. This track, True Blues, from the early 50s, is about 6 or 7 blues choruses. It's just off the charts great. And then there's a beautiful ballad rendition of I Should Care, where you can really hear, you know, Milt singing on the instrument. Thank you.
vibraphonist Mill Jackson performing I Should Care with Horace Silver on piano, Percy Heath on bass, and Connie Kay on drums, recorded for the Prestige label in 1955. I'll have more Detroit jazz and commentary from Mark Stryker in just a few moments. You can listen to many previous Nightlights programs on our website at wfiu.org/nightlights. Production support comes from Landlocked Music, offering new and used CDs, LPs, and more, now located in the David Baker Building at 115 South Walnut in downtown Bloomington, Indiana, or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe, serving veggie burgers, salads, and burritos for lunch and dinner. Outdoor seating available at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant. The Laughing Planet Cafe, online at thelaughingplanetcafe.com. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Made in Detroit, Jazz from the Motor City, Part 1, on Nightlights. Featuring Detroit jazz artists on this edition of Nightlights and talking with Mark Stryker, author of the book Jazz from Detroit, which documents both the evolution of the city's mid-20th century jazz scene and its continuing contributions to the greater world of jazz in the late 20th and early 21st century. And if you're going to talk or write about that, you have to consider three Detroit brothers, pianist Hank Jones, trumpeter Thad Jones, and drummer Elvin Jones.
Hank, Thad, and Elvin get their own chapter because they are a family, and I think they're the greatest family in jazz history. And I also think that the three of them embody something important about Detroit, which is a kind of versatility. Detroit musicians are really versatile, and I think it's so interesting to think about the fact that from Hank to Elvin, all within one family, you basically can cover every style of jazz from ragtime to, say, no time. And it's interesting, too, because it also gives you a snapshot of how swiftly the history moved in jazz because, you know, Hank was born in 1918, Thad in 23, and Elvin in 27. So there's like 9 years between the brothers. But all three of them came up in really kind of distinctively different periods. Hank is a fully blown musician through the late swing era, and he's among the first adapters of this new bebop style. And when you talk to Hank, he would tell you, you know, he'd never considered himself a bebop player. He always felt like he was sort of reaching out for it, but wasn't really a fully fledged bebop player. Thad grows up, you know, in the heart of the bebop era, and Dizzy Gillespie is his hero. He makes his career, of course, starting with Basie, Thad does, but he's really a bebop player going forward. And then Elvin comes up kind of at the point at which bebop is morphing into hard bop, and then Elvin becomes this leader of the nascent avant-garde playing with John Coltrane. And so all three of them, they're only 9 years apart. That's really not that much. And yet, because jazz was moving so swiftly, they all are formed by a different cadre of influences. And yet they all can sort of reference all of the other points along the jazz timeline. Thank you.
Thank you.
Trumpeter Thad Jones and his composition Let's Play One, backed by a nearly all fellow Detroiters band with tenor saxophonist Billy Mitchell, pianist Tommy Flanagan, bassist Paul Chambers, drummer Elvin Jones, and the sole non-Detroiter, trombonist Al Gray. Thad's brother Hank before that with a solo piano rendition of Gone with the Wind. The Jones brothers were just three of the many highly talented jazz musicians who ultimately left the spiritually and professionally supportive climate of Detroit.
I mean, musicians are ambitious. They want to test themselves against the very, very best. They want to make records. They want to play with their heroes. And, you know, New York is the center of the jazz universe. Particularly in the 1950s, it becomes the center of jazz recording as the long playing record comes in. And so, you know, it's natural that you're going to have an exodus, that people are always going to find their way to New York. That's a long tradition in the history of jazz. So players do leave. And of course, you know, the major theme of the book is, you know, the book is really about the fact that you cannot tell the history of jazz in America without also telling the history of jazz from Detroit, because we produce so many great players, so many innovators, and so many foot soldiers and creative, you know, high stylists. The book really traces that diaspora and the impact of an Elvin Jones or a Thad Jones or a Joe Henderson or Ron Carter as they grow up in Detroit and how that informed their lives. And then as they move on and how that influence then has a much broader impact across all of American music.
One such musician, trombonist Curtis Fuller, made an immediate impact upon arriving in New York City in 1957. At the age of 22, Fuller recorded with notable artists such as John Coltrane, Bud Powell, and Jimmy Smith, appearing on 6 albums as a leader and 15 others as a sideman, all amounting to one of the most striking debuts in the history of jazz. Mark Stryker on a standout Fuller moment with Coltrane.
The 5 choruses that Curtis Fuller plays on Blue Train, I mean, if Curtis did nothing else for the rest of his career, we would still be talking about those 5 choruses because of how, first of all, just the iconic sound of Train and Curtis Fuller playing the melody together. That in itself is a jazz sound that we are all familiar with and love. But then when you listen to Curtis's solo and the way he develops his ideas and the way it moves into double time and the way it moves out of double time back into single time. And there's an incredible moment at the end, at the 4th chorus going into the 5th chorus where he takes a breath and kind of relaxes a minute, and the time goes from double time back to single time, and Curtis plays this descending blues line that's just so swinging and so soulful. It's a, you know, God is in the details kind of idea. That's such a beautiful moment that sort of epitomizes the spirit that Curtis brought to the music. Detroit trombonist Curtis Fuller heard on John Coltrane's 1957 recording of Blue Train, one of numerous albums that Fuller appeared on during his first year in New York City. Trumpeter Donald Byrd was another Detroit jazz musician who left the city and hit his stride in the late 1950s. Donald Byrd was really at his peak between about 1958 and 1961. Kind of in there, his trumpet playing was at a really, really high level at that point. He had been studying at the Manhattan School of Music and at Juilliard with some very important mid-century trumpet teachers, William Vacchiano and Joe Alessi Sr., very important mid-century trumpet teachers. And so Donald's chops at that point were really, really strong. And he had outgrown some of his early virtuosity and was playing with more space and more lyricism. And so on a track like When Your Love Is Gone, which is an original as opposed to the standard When Your Lover Is Gone, but When Your Love Is Gone, recorded in 1958, just the sound of the trumpet is so juicy and fat and romantic, and there's just so much feeling in that, the way he plays that ballad.
With Detroit trumpeter Donald Byrd performing his composition When Your Love Has Gone, backed by Wynton Kelly on piano, Sam Jones on bass, and Art Taylor on drums, from the album Off to the Races. Thanks for tuning in this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Mark Stryker. Tune in next week for Made in Detroit, Jazz from the Motor City, Part 2. You can listen to previous Nightlights programs on our website at wfiu.org/nightlights. Production support comes from Landlocked Music, offering new and used CDs, LPs, and more. Now located in the David Baker Building at 115 South Walnut in downtown Bloomington, Indiana, or online at landlockedmusic.com. and from the Laughing Planet Cafe, serving veggie burgers, salads, and burritos for lunch and dinner. Outdoor seating available at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant. The Laughing Planet Cafe, online at thelaughingplanetcafe.com. Nightlights is a production of WFIU and part of the educational mission of Indiana University. I'm David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.